But yeah, that's like the difference, I guess, difference between, you know, mass produced things and handmade things, you know, kind of, it's maybe like a oversimplified way of describing the two things.
But we want the individuality, right? Like that's what kind of what we're chasing. It's as Matt said, you know, like we're chasing wherever that blank's going, and we're trying to find something unique in everything that we do because that's kind of the art form. You know, it's like every time you play, you want it to be a bit different too, right? Like you're chasing that thing. So, and obviously, as you say, because of that, our output is minuscule in comparison to all the other things because it has to be. But it's fun. It's fun to do. It's nice to have that ability to not have to be boxed in to do, you know, one thing in a certain way. So.
Yeah, I've been trying to think of a way to sort of bridge the gap between things that are more, I guess, more common, and you can produce them faster, you can get them out for a lower price, all this kind of stuff that is more big business concepts. And then also the what you just described, Craig, and you know, wondering if there's even a if there's a possibility for us to somehow kind of take some elements of big business that actually allows us to make a living doing this, because this is, Craig and I were talking earlier, it's like a it is a labor of love, and it's, you don't get into doing this to make a boatload of money. You know, you're kind of like, it's like being a musician. I mean, like a gigging musician, you're not, you don't have a salary. You don't have, you know, maybe some have salaries, but you don't have a salary necessarily. You don't have health benefits. You don't have all these things that make life a little bit easier to manage. You kind of, yeah, you have to sacrifice that. So, have you got, I guess maybe this is a question about the business aspect of it, but just how do you guys kind of ride the line between making what you need, you know, making enough money to live, but also still keeping a sense of purity about the art form?
Matt. Usually by the seat of my pants, you know, it's like I've just managed to pay for my flight to Chicago and now I've got to do the rent in like another 10 days. So I'm waiting for someone else to pay me for that. And yeah, it's just like, you know, bouncing along the bottom really most of the time.
Bouncing
Which
along the bottom, I like that. I might do a series called that. Bouncing along the bottom. You didn't try that. I mean, I've gotten pretty good at you know, saving. So when I've made a bit of money, I'll put it away, and that'll kind of get me through, as Matt said, those times where, you know, your hot water's busted and your car's broken and your kid's got all these school expenses. And you know, because yeah, sometimes if they hit you at the wrong time and you got nothing in reserve, it can be pretty tough. So, but I seem to be threading the needle, shall we say, of doing that. Are you still working, doing other stuff, Matt, or are you doing this full time now?
Oh, full time. There was a period when I did a little bit, like 3 days a week of another job. But back to full time again.
Oh, awesome. Great.
I mean,
For
I
how long?
suppose I get away with it maybe easier than some. Because I make a lot of different things, you know, orchestras are always buying tubular bells or triangles or, you know, things like that that are quicker to make. They're more of a process than an art, if you know what I mean. You know, you could literally write a list of instructions and have someone do it who was reasonably skilled. You know, it doesn't really depend on your ear that much, whereas, you know, cymbal making is a lot more involved, as are gongs and things. So having that breadth, certainly in, you know, what is really quite a small UK market, you know, helps me stay afloat. And you know, there's enough people buying from Europe and the States, despite, you know, all the Brexit nonsense that's made it harder to do that, but
Yeah,
still
that's a
possible.
shift at home. So do you do a lot of shipping though still? Like, are you still shipping all over the shop as well a lot? Or
I mean, what have I just shipped? I've France, Hong Kong, Japan,
yeah, cool. Yes, yeah, okay.
States. Yeah.
Yeah. And you go to the States pretty much every year, right?
I go to PASIC every year because that is a good show for all the things I do, and it always brings money back in. I've had a fair break from any of the other shows. I did Chicago again last year. I'm doing it this year. But I hadn't been there for a while. But that's usually a pretty good show. And it's much less expensive than PASIC.
Yeah, it seems like PASIC was the most expensive show I've done, but definitely seems like it's worth, if it's worth it, if you, I still have to dial in what exactly I'm bringing, because I haven't quite figured out the clientele, so to speak, of that show, even though I mean, I focus mostly on drum set stuff, but there's quite a few drum set players that go and whatnot. But yeah, it seems like the best show if you can swing the high cost to get there and to do it. Chicago, I'm interested to know if Chicago is going to be the same this year, just with, because last year they were, you know, highlighting the Cymbalsmiths and had a brochure and all that, and I don't know how many people came specifically for that, and it, because I did pretty well last year. I'm interested to see kind of the comparison with this year and see if it's going to be kind of the same. It seems like they should do it, because a lot of people were telling me it was the best Chicago show that they've been to in ages. That's what I had a lot of feedback like that when I was there, just from people walking around that were like, this has so many more booths, a lot of really cool booths this time, like it's much better than it was, blah blah blah. I was kind of wondering if they wouldn't make it a staple to have the Cymbalsmiths kind of featured. And maybe that's, maybe
yeah,
that's,
I don't know. I guess years back it was very much a sort of old vintage parts sort of trade kind of show type thing, you know, bring all your spares and swap them with someone else, that kind of thing. I guess eBay and stuff, internet, Facebook has totally killed that market in person. So maybe there were a few years while things sort of adjusted in terms of who was coming to exhibit there.
I didn't realize that. That's interesting. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You go there, yeah, you bring all your like one-off Slingerland lugs that you want to trade with someone for. Yeah.
Yeah, like tables with boxes and boxes of all those kind of bits. In the first couple of years that I went. But yeah, I guess so. People were telling you that they liked the variety of the booths, but they weren't just talking about cymbals, talking about the whole thing, cymbals and drums and everything else that was there.
Yeah, they were just raving about the whole thing. So maybe they were the ones that had just started coming in the last few years or whatnot. I'm sure it took a dip. Obviously, it took a dip in 2020.
Yeah,
so.
Pandemic as well, yeah, sure.
Right. So,
yeah, it'll be interesting to see this year what it's like, because there are actually a fair number of cymbal booths again. Slightly different mix, but, you know, a good number. So it'll be interesting to see if it works as well.
Yeah. So you were saying that it's, I don't know how to pronounce it, but is it Nathaniel or Nathaniel, the guy, the Israeli Smith?
I don't know how you pronounce it either.
If you're listening, I'm so sorry. love your work, but you were saying that he was going to be coming and he's not anymore. I didn't know there was going to be other people just coming to attend. It's kind of interesting that how many of the newer Smiths, which I am a newer Smith, I'll fully state that, but like the newer Smiths were coming to kind of just attend the show and kind of see if it was something they wanted.
Well, so he was going to share Burke's booth, the bronze pipe booth. He was going to have presence there.
Yeah, interesting.
But there's GM Designs are here, and there was a guy last year who had a lot of reworks, like on the small part of someone else's, like a drum booth. He's got his own full booth this year. So yeah, it's gonna be interesting.
Interesting, yeah. So, what do you guys think? Being the kind of the old guard, I mean, what do you guys think of how cymbal market has changed? And you think it's a good thing? Is it, you know, gimmicky? Is it, you know, are we seeing this big rise, and then are we going to see this big drop off where like a bunch of people stop because they realize it's really hard? And you know, what do you guys think?
Well, I think it's I think it's good to see lots of different people doing it, because it is a craft, and I like the idea that there's people passionately doing that stuff, and I think there's enough of a market. But as you say, the tough thing is that it's hard to really, you know, as one person making symbols, it's hard to really do well in the business sense. So I guess that's limiting in a way, but part of the positive of that is that it generally means that it's people that are really passionate about it. So, you know, they're actually really into it. They love doing it. They love the idea of exploring sounds and experimenting and doing all that stuff. And, you know, I'm sure you guys are the same. Pretty much every day I have something that I experiment with, you know, some wacky thing that I'm trying or doing. And it's so cool to be able to, maybe you don't get paid for specifically that, but you're getting paid to be able to do that as well as, you know, the stuff that we do. So I think it's cool. And I think also too with internet and the fact that you can reach more people, it's, you know, Nick said something I thought was really good the other day, and he was saying, you know, like the thing to focus on is trying to figure out how much you need to survive and just really focus on that. And don't worry about all that other stuff. Again, the problem is need to survive. So that's different for everybody. And
that's not necessarily a low bar. That can actually be kind of a high bar.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. That's right. And yeah, and of course, you know, with shipping and man, I get, because I'm in Australia, I'm in the arse end of the world. So I just get hammered for shipping and duties and things. It's. Whew, you know, since COVID, it's just really expensive now. So
shipping materials have gone up.
What do you think? What do you think about the, you know, because I loved Dave's graphic. He's done a thing of the world with lots of the symbolsmiths on it. Have you seen that on his website?
It's crazy.
It's great, I was impressed at how many people are doing it. Because when we did it, how many people were doing it when we started?
Oh, not many. Feels like there were maybe three or four, sort of the previous generation in a way.
Yeah.
And then you, me, and Bettis, and a couple of others, Heather and people, like a little later maybe, were sort of the layer under that, the new guys. Now, I don't know how many sort of generations we are on from there, two or three maybe, in terms of... Yeah. Sort of waves of interest in new people.
And it's the thing I love about you, Matt, is that you do such different stuff. Like it's different alloys. Like your understanding of all that stuff is fantastic. And do you like doing lots of different stuff? Like, is that something that you know? Because I'm a bit more, you know, like I have sounds in my head and I'm trying to get them, and I'm a little bit more spitzikino in that way. Just in, you know, I kind of have, of course, I branch out and I do different stuff. But you seem to just have such a wide range of alloys, and like you say, all the orchestral stuff that you're doing, and
you know, I suppose I enjoy variety myself. You know, keeps me interested. I think if I was making the same or very much the same thing over and over, or aiming for the same thing all the time, I might, you know, not as dedicated to a certain sound like that as other people may be. I guess I'm a less broad these days in terms of cymbal styles, but that's more following where people are buying things. Certainly started out, it was very, you know, very broad. Trying to find new things, really.
Yeah.
You know, new sounds or new angles or new ways that, you know, drummers or percussionists could use stuff.
Yeah.
I suppose its focus has narrowed a bit since then, but I still do the weird and wacky things here and there.
Yeah. And you seem to have like a pretty good access for blanks from lots of different places to do different projects and that. Are you still able to access lots of different blank sources and stuff?
More or less. I mean, it's not so easy with Germany anymore. Just mainly with the size of the order. I can't afford to sort of buy the order size you need to get stuff from them. But you know, and still get things from, you know, a couple of guys in Turkey, and then the Koide alloys sometimes, but just like ones and twos. It's not like I'm buying lots, so it's probably inefficient in terms of shipping cost and that kind of thing. But it's interesting. Someone made an inquiry recently about a gong, like a 34 inch gong. It's like, oh, I've got one blank left and I need to buy 20 more to make that one gong for this guy. It's like, so that may not go ahead, just depending on how many other people place orders for things.
Yeah, that's tough.
How would you feel like you what's your story of developing the ear that you have? Because we might have talked about this when we had our podcast a little bit, touched on it a little bit, but that's the thing, you know, I'm kind of with Craig on when I have heard your stuff and played it in person, I'll play, you know, you had a symbol that was, I think you described it as like a Tony-esque symbol or some kind of very jazz specific sound. And I remember playing that being like, wow, that is like, to me, it felt like as spot on of a symbol to that sound as I've ever heard. It felt like it, you know, when you guys play the kind of symbols that, you know, there's a huge depth of knowledge that went into making that instrument. It wasn't just kind of like a happenstance that you happened to nail that sound, but then you also are doing all the orchestral stuff and the triangles and all this. Like, how do you feel like you spend a lot of time developing your ear with that? Or was it something you kind of just barreled into as you were making instruments?
I suppose it's not something I've deliberately developed, but I have noticed that it has become developed. You know, I remember when I first started, I suddenly thought, hang on, I've got a hearing problem that I'd never noticed before. But it's only because I was really listening to things that I started like just questioning what I was hearing. And got a little test, and sure enough, there's a little notch in this ear at like 4K or something where someone once shouted very loud in a nightclub. But I mean, you know, it's not to the degree that I can't hear properly. You know, this one's still fine. And your brain, you know, is compensating all the time for that kind of thing. But part of developing the cymbal sound, having started with trying to do everything different and not follow anything, then a bunch of people were coming with like, well, I've got this old half-broken cymbal, but I like how it sounded before it was broken. Can you sort of replicate it or remake it or you know, do something that's an homage to that sound? So then I really started doing a bit of sort of reverse engineering stuff, just looking at shapes and profiles and, you know, how tension was varying. So a little bit, you know, of knowledge that I've gained from studying, you know, say, you know, some old K's or some old Spitzikinos, Spitzikini. So again, you know, as I said at the beginning, I think before we started recording, standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, there is knowledge from before that is somewhat hidden, but you can kind of get some of it out and then find the correlation between the sound and the shape.
Mm-hmm. And make those links in your brain and kind of know, knowing that you can kind of aim in a general direction with a certain shape and you know you're going to land in a certain sonic zone.
Yeah.
And from there, you're kind of dialing in. And, you know, it's all becoming finer and finer until you decide it's finished, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. I find, you know, a lot of the people making cymbals and kind of, you know, presenting, hey, these are the cymbals that I make. I've noticed that there's been a way, a lot of people are just categorizing the cymbals by these very like kind of catchphrasy terms like Old K clone or such and such tribute or whatever, this way of kind of, which I don't fully dislike that, because I feel like it does help the person that wants to purchase it kind of define what it is they're purchasing. So that, you know, obviously we have to do that to some extent, but where are you guys at when it comes to, you know, cause I think about, you know, did Brian Blade give you permission to use his name on that symbol you just posted for sale? Like, you know, did Tony Williams estate, did you get a license from them in order to kind of market your product that you're selling? I have a little bit of a internal conflict with that aspect. And I wonder if that's ever going to if anyone's going to ever, and maybe this is me doing it right now, I wonder if anyone's going to call that out as a practice and say, maybe we need to be a little bit more thoughtful in our approach to how we market our symbols, just to be, have you ever dove down that rabbit hole?
I don't know. It's like you say, I think a lot of it though is you have to sell symbols and you have to market symbols, and sound is so difficult to describe. And so I think sometimes talking about maybe where the inspiration for that came from, or what direction you think that symbol is heading in sonically, you know, maybe that can be an okay thing. I guess it depends on, how rip-offy it is, or how much you're trying to really use the weight of somebody else to market what it is that you're doing. And man, I don't know.
I'm not a good marketer.
I don't know how that works. So.
As a caveat, I don't know if you guys have ever done that, but my perception is that there's a tasteful way of doing it and an understated way of doing it. When you are literally just trying to say, here's a symbol, it is akin to this kind of sound. There's a way of doing that, which I find I have zero issue with that. I think that's actually, like you're saying, a good way of helping the customer understand what it is they're getting. But I feel like both of you guys have developed, and obviously you've been around doing this for a long time, so you've developed your own sound. And there's something, you know, even if, say, Craig is to, you know, today, maybe you post a Tony Williams tribute symbol, right? I would still feel, and I obviously am tapped into this little niche industry, but I would still feel like the Craig Lauritsen sound is still going to be above the Tony Williams tribute descriptor that you use for that one little symbol. You know, you guys have both developed over, you know, have both been doing this over a decade. I don't know, maybe over two decades. So there's like a sense of you kind of put in the work to build your own voice, build your own sound. And then from there, you can kind of maybe even create your own terminology to say, this is my symbol sound that is the blank series or whatever. And that's what I'm trying to do, is like come up with my own terminology that captures sound characteristics I can describe. And hopefully, you know, the goal would be maybe one day that series name that I made up last year will actually have its own weight behind it, so that I'm not having to say, this is a Spizzichino clone, or, you know what I mean? Or, does that make sense?
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a tough one. As you say, though, I mean, obviously, if it's an individual symbol smith making a symbol, regardless of what they're tipping their hat to, it's going to have them in that symbol. And I think that's part of the point, hopefully. You know, you want to be able to have a sound that you're going for and have some kind of consistency with your sound in the things that you're producing, regardless of whether you're trying to tip a hat to whoever it is, Roy Haynes, Tony Williams, you know. But yeah, I guess, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say about it, really. Because if someone asks to get a, you know, an 18-inch flat ride that sounds like, you know, on Now He Sings, Now He Sobs, it's kind of, how do you, like, when you put that up and say what it is, you kind of, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's, yeah, like, totally.
Because obviously that was the inspiration, and you're trying to push it in that direction, at least hopefully a little bit. So,
right.
I agree with that.
I agree with that. And I've been trying to decide if I feel personally okay with, you know, on these random projects, because I have had projects, one that I'm about to finish up now, where it was like a very specific symbol, old K, you know, old stamp 3 or a 2B old stamp, you know, 1960, this very specific symbol. I was able to like figure out, or the customer got in touch with the guy who owned it, took pictures of the exact symbol, all the shapes and profiles of the bell and everything, and got me the exact weight, the exact diameter, 21.5 inches, you know. And you're really like zoning in on an exact sound. And it would be silly on the flip side for me to like put that symbol up, or maybe make another one like it and say, this is one from my blankety blank series, you know, because that's not, it is actually very much a targeted symbol sound. So it's, you know, I think with that, there's not necessarily a right answer to it. I think more so my weird feelings about it just come in when it seems as if some of the younger Smiths aren't necessarily working to try to build their own voice and actually like put themselves out there as like, I have a sound, or I'm trying to develop my sound, and then let that be kind of the main thing. And then on the side, you can kind of say, okay, I made this symbol to sound like a Spiz. I made this one to sound like an Elvin, you know, and kind of make it maybe like reorganize and reprioritize things. And I feel the pressure to, you know, put a name on a video or a symbol, because those do better online. You get more feedback when you say Tony Williams, you get more feedback than when you say, this is my complex ride, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's pretty much what you said, Timothy. It's how tastefully it's done, how respectfully it is done. You know, if it's the crutch that's getting you to sell the symbol, or you're misrepresenting it, that's not really what it is. It's just, you know, a label you've put on it to try to sell it. Or, you know, if it's in any way dishonest, or the primary thing rather than the secondary or tertiary thing, then it leaves a bad taste, doesn't it? But it's hard to judge, you know, and I'm sure, you know, one person's line is, you know, different to another person's.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of, you know, whether you've overstepped it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, in a perfect world, it'd be great just to, you know, have every symbol just have your name on it. And that's, you know, like Spiz, that's kind of what he did. I mean, I know he had series, but they were fairly loose, really. Like the series, often you get four cars together and they're pretty different. So really it was just always Spiz. And that would be lovely to not even have to think about that, you know, like, but yeah, I guess most of us don't live in that world. You know, we still have to market stuff and figure out how everything fits together. Like Matt said, I think it's more just about, you know, whether you're being authentic or just trying to dupe something somehow, you know, like I think it just comes down to your own personal, you know, authenticity about what it is you're trying to do. But
yeah. And actually, yeah. You know, maybe thinking about it, if you kind of relate it to playing, there's always kind of the mimic stage or the Mickey Mouse stage in a player's life. You kind of, if you're only listening to Elvin, you know, and you only pull out the Elvin licks when you play, you know, people will be like, you're just trying to copy Elvin. But that can be a way to develop your own sound, kind of a pathway to get to that point where you go, okay, now that I did the Elvin thing, I'm not going to do that anymore, because it's, you know, I'm going to put that aside. It's internalized, but I'm going to put it aside and not be intentionally putting out there all the rolling triplets and stuff to try to, you know, have that kind of sound. And I'm going to try to ask a deeper, harder question, which is, what is my sound? What is the Timothy Roberts cymbal sound? What is the, you know, that is a much harder question to actually ask than just looking at someone you respect and going, well, they did it. They developed their sound. And so let me just kind of take from that and let that, you know, kind of be mine. And maybe it's just kind of like an artistic integrity matter where you just feel like at a certain point you get a little tired of just copying other people's stuff or always trying to sound like something else. And you kind of go, maybe it feels like there's more integrity and actually asking that difficult question of who am I? What is my artistic voice? And what do I want my symbols to sound like, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, it's about, obviously, I think because we're, I don't know how to describe us really, like, I mean, artists, I don't know. I mean, we're obviously passionate about sound and we're passionate about exploring sound and figuring out, you know, how we can realize something that we hear in our heads, at least to a pretty decent degree. And probably all the guys, I don't know. I mean, I can't say because I don't, you know, I haven't had long conversations with a lot of the younger guys. But I think mostly they're probably still trying to do their own thing. Like, because I mean, even if you trying, like, okay, so to me, you can, like you say, go through a phase where you try and sound like an artist, but eventually you realize that you're never going to, no matter how much you try, you'll never be that artist. So the only thing you can ultimately really be is you. And so that becomes the thing you explore more and more, is your relationship to that thing. And that's kind of what we're talking about, right? Like, we're all just exploring our relationship to this thing that we're doing. And I don't know who's authentic and who isn't, but I think probably even if you're doing this, you're already probably halfway there. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is just flat out not worth spending the mental energy and time to try and judge who is authentic and who isn't. Because if you're patient enough, I feel like that stuff kind of all is revealed in the end. You know, it's all going to be revealed. The people that are authentic are going to still be, you know, in a decade or two decades or whatever. Or maybe, you know, maybe not necessarily that they'll still be around, but that the work will kind of reveal itself in, you know, looking back, it'll reveal itself as true in some sense, you know. And like you said, Craig, there's a different line for what people will tolerate and what they deem to be authentic and inauthentic. And, you know, yeah. I know that I love cymbal sounds, and I really am like trying to aim at seeing what's possible with this material, bronze. But I know, I mean, there's been plenty of comments online that people have leveled against me that, you know, I'm a charlatan or, you know, whatever.
Well, there's so many rumors, right? Like, you hear stuff about yourself all the time. It's fascinating where they come from.
Like, well, I didn't know that about myself.
yeah, exactly. But, you know, again, that's just the nature of things. And who was it that said that it's what other people say about you is none of your business? It's kind of nice to be in that zone, you know, because you can get bogged down and worry about that stuff, and it's just takes you away from what it is you're trying to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know.
Kills your focus and whatnot.
Yeah. You know, like, and again, if you're passionate and you're exploring stuff, I mean, you're doing the best you can do. So that's all you can do, right? Like, you can only do you, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guarantee you, if we all got together and played each other's cymbals, there would be a vibe in every single one of them that I could go, yeah, man, that's a Timothy vibe, or that's a Matt vibe, or that's a, you know, probably a bunch of the young cats vibe as well. You naturally have a thing. We're all mechanically kind of different, and we, you know,
right,
we have different tools that we kind of match with our body mechanics, and we have a, the beautiful thing about this is that if it doesn't matter who hammers a cymbal, it's always going to be a little bit different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So depending on who it is that's putting into it. Did we lose Matt?
I think we lost him. We'll see if he hops back on here. Yeah. Do you find that your mood when you go to the anvil and pick up that hammer, do you find that like your mental state, your mood has a great effect on whatever you produce? Or have you been able to kind of, like, I don't know, get past that and be able to be more consistent? Or do you like to allow your emotions and your feelings to kind of imbue into the bronze? And
that's a really good question. I think, because let's face it, if you've had a hammering day where you've done, you know, 4 to 6 hours of hammering, man, that's a lot of hammer strokes. And I think you do just naturally get into a pattern that is your default setting. And you can try and modify that depending on what you're doing. But it's like anything that you do a million times, you kind of have a default way of doing that. And I think that's just what happens naturally while you do it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when you listen to different people, they have a default touch. They have a, like, if they're playing drums, you know, they have a different touch, a different way that they extract a sound from something. And that's just from doing it a zillion times. And I think that's naturally happens to everybody. Sometimes I like to just mix it up and, you know, go a bit crazy. And I've purposely, you know, particularly with the Sabian blanks, I've purposefully just made them terrible. Like they're all just a taco, and it's like, man, if I push this so far, I can't actually get it back. And part of that is that I do like to push boundaries on things.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes I do purposefully do that just for myself, for a challenge. And I don't know, there's, you know what it's like, there's something about, it's like humanity. Like you have this point where I call it like the resilience point. So if you don't have enough stresses, then you kind of weaken. You don't have a good way of dealing with things. If you have too much, it breaks you. So you want something in the middle that's that resilient point, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kind of think about that often the same way in symbols. You know, if I'm just not pushing it hard enough, I don't think that's great. And of course, if, you know, generally, if I push it too hard, that's probably not great either. So I'm trying to find that point where, you know, I've pushed it enough that it's found its own resilience point, which hopefully is like the optimum point for where it wants to be. But
wow, that's a really, I mean, my mind is kind of like blown by that, because that actually like verbalizes something I've like, has only been like a feeling for me, is like if a symbol, there's just there is something. And I was talking to Jesse Simpson about this, and he was really focusing in on like the feel of a symbol, how the stick bounces off the symbol, how the symbol moves, is a factor that some people might not pay much attention to. They might just go, oh, the sound is it, but there's this whole thing about like the feel. And and there's and that made me think about the times where I will hit a symbol and it just feels like there's something about it that's just feeling kind of boring, I guess. Okay, here's Matt. He's coming back. And I find that those symbols, oftentimes I kind of just carbon copied a method onto, and maybe this is a way of describing it, where they haven't had enough stress to have their own resilience. What did you say? What was the term you said about
that? Like that resilience window, you know, where you've pushed it enough that it's found a really good place for itself. Because if you don't push it enough, it doesn't find it. And if you push it too much, it breaks or cracks, or you know what a symbol that's been hammered too much sounds like as well. Like it's a vibe, but it kind of goes to a place that you can never come back from either. So
right.
Yeah. I'm trying to find the optimum point.
Right. Yeah. Matt, in the interim, when you left us,
sorry about that.
No worries. Craig had this, was talking about this, which he just described, but this kind of finding this optimum resilience point, where it's like, if you don't push yourself hard enough, then you haven't like torn your muscles down enough to build strength. You haven't built the resilience in the material. And if you push it too hard, it breaks or it goes too far. And we're all trying to find this point. And so he was talking about just purposely taking a symbol way too far to just see, you know, can he bring it back, or can he, like, you know, just to kind of like maybe go into a danger zone a little bit to maybe find some kind of, like you said, optimum resilience point with the material. And I was just saying that connects with me, because I've been working with these Sabian blanks, and they respond way different. And they sound way different. So I'm trying to find what is the optimum place for this sonic palette, and what symbol design copied onto a Sabian blank is going to yield a result that I would really dig playing. And oftentimes I'm finding that doing something kind of crazy with it, or like really pushing it far, is what's needed to kind of bring out some sort of interesting vibe with that material. Like I yesterday was lathing on these cymbals that I'm keeping the top Turk and just burnishing it and doing a lot of weight removal from the underside. And I was just finding that like it was getting boring, and I was getting frustrating, and I'd been in the shop for 10 hours. And at the end of the day yesterday, I went in and just burnished harder than I think I ever have. And, you know, the cymbal, you know, it was flipped inside out. So, you know, I loosened the tension and the cymbal just like some tacos the opposite way. And then I'm like, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to like wrench this thing back into the regular shape. And I was able to, and the shape was a little weird. And there was like some points where I could kind of press in at the edges and get some softness. But then I put it up on the cymbal stand and I played it, and I was like, Okay, wait. I think something happened. Something happened there. And I've yet to play it this morning, but it's like it was the need to kind of like take things too far or like push a little farther than what would be wise that kind of led somewhere there where I went, okay, finally I'm feeling like there's life in here somehow. And I'm gonna keep going down this path and try to find it. Matt, do you have anything like that that you, or yeah, Craig, you wanna tag on to that?
Was that a Sabian blank that you were doing that too? Or?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, obviously the Turkish blanks I get, I don't know what blanks you guys are getting, but they're terrible, right? Like they're sheared appallingly. The shears are blunt as and it bends the edge of the symbol. And, you know, when they're rolled, there's all of these bumps and it's like they've been run over by a truck. And like there's no way that I can shape that without putting a lot of time and energy and effort into it. Whereas, as you say, the Sabians are just, you can shape them pretty quickly because they're just way more consistent and you know, a lot easier to do that with. So, yeah, I always find too with the Sabian ones, I really have to, like, you know, I really have to go to town on those. You know, I have to find my inner dark side and really put it into that Sabian because otherwise they can be a little bit, I don't know, just because the Turks have that color. Inherently they have that color because it's the way that they've made it is just way less consistent and you know they do all the different things. So yeah, I find as well with the Sabians I really go hard on those things. I do crazy stuff to them to try and get something interesting out of them, you know.
Yeah And there's a cool juxtaposition between what is a very clean and pristine blank and it has a kind of clean sound naturally and sort of a little bit of a one-dimensional. I say one-dimensional, not necessarily in a bad thing, in a bad way.
No, but no, they're amazing blanks. I mean, they're fantastic.
They're amazing, yeah. And I'm, you know, I will definitely continue ordering because I've found the way I like to use them for certain things. But the sonic frequency, you know, if you've got your highs, mids, lows, it just feels a little bit more like squished. And so with the Sabian blanks, it's like the crazy methods and the, you know, lifting your hammer up here to get the big strike and you're kind of lifting to get a little air under the anvil as you do it to really just like those little methods kind of help take that range that's here and kind of stretch it out so that when you play it, you're like, oh, okay, now I'm hearing all the frequencies I want to hear, like more of a spectrum that I'm used to or that I'm aiming for, you know. Hey, Matt, what's your thoughts on this little rabbit trail?
Yeah, in agreement, really. I guess when I first started B20 with the Wieland, the German material, so like the Piety 602 type stuff, and certainly going from that to Turkish, suddenly like, oh, I can't work this Turkish stuff as much because I'm cracking it, you know, especially like hammering cups and things. So then I had to sort of reel back a little bit. And then recently I've worked a couple of Sabian blanks that I got from Bettis years and years ago and made one of them and didn't do anything with the rest. And that's like worse, not the right word, but more extreme than the German material. Like you've got to put a lot more effort in to get it near sort of what you get almost for free with Turkish. But then there's all those other things you have to do.
Well, I like that term, what you get for free. I love that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's an expression in the UK, swings and roundabouts, you know, what you lose on the swings, you gain on the roundabouts, sort of playground analogy. So, yeah, everything has its advantages and disadvantages. Part of the craft is learning how to deal with those things.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And make the best out of everything.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Or choose the blanks depending on what final result you're aiming for. You know, something that's going to give you the first step rather than, you know, having to fight hard to get to that point.
Yeah. So for the lay person, how would you guys describe what we're even talking about? Like, why is a German blank or a Sabian blank, why is it doing that versus what the Turkish? We've kind of alluded to it a little bit. With just the, you know, essentially it all comes down to method, methodology of taking the copper and the tin and how you turn that into a blank. But like, how would you guys kind of go farther to describe you know, what it is that makes the Sabians like that, the German blanks like that, and Turkish and so forth.
Trying to think of an everyday analogy that actually works. It's tricky. This analogy is going to fail, but I'm going to go for it anyway. It's a bit like if you make your own pizza at home, and you either start with like a supermarket bought pizza base, which might be a Sabian or a German blank, or you know you sort of make the dough yourself, or you have someone in Turkey make the dough for you, and it's all a bit gnarly and bubbly, and it's got like burnt bits on the edges. But this got automatic character from that. Whereas with the plain base, maybe you need to put more toppings and different stuff on to get to as interesting a dish in the end.
That's a terrible analogy. And yeah, it is. It's about that, that because of the, obviously, Sabians, you know, they've got all of the tech to make these really consistent, incredibly durable, fantastic blanks. But obviously, because of that, as Matt said, you're losing, because the character comes from the stressing. The character comes from the randomness. The character comes from sitting out of the oven too long, or you know, being heated up way too much before they had the next round of the rolling, or, you know, that's kind of where a lot of that inbuilt character is coming from, which obviously the Turkish naturally have, because that's the way that they do their thing. They're looking at heat purely from the visual thing of it. So it's going to have a little bit more of, again, character funk, something cool about it. But the Sabians are great, though, because in the sense that you're starting much more with a consistent raw thing. So, you know, like everything, if you want to take that somewhere, you have to put all of that in there, because it doesn't have any of that. Well, again, I shouldn't say they're characterless, because that's unfair, but they don't certainly have that really interesting spice that the Turkish stuff have. So yeah, you have to put that in yourself, you know.
It's more of a blank slate, isn't it? So
yeah,
you can perhaps go more places with it.
Yes.
You know, and you can take it in the Turkish direction or in a different direction.
It all
comes from you, or more of it comes from you.
I was feeling with the, when I first made, this is making me think that, you know, any new symbolsmith, I don't know if Sabian would be willing to do this, but if you were able to make a few, like if you're brand new, you're in your first year or whatever, if you were able to work with Sabian in the beginning, like a Sabian type blank, a cleaner blank that's more consistent, all of that, in conjunction with working Turkish, it might be a good way of developing skill. Because I just remember, not that it's necessarily, it would be better, but every symbol, the first 100 symbols I made were all very, very funky, very, very tonal, very complex and dark and dirty and nasty. And I just remember being frustrated and wanting really bad, just wanting to figure out how to make a Turkish blank sound clean. Like if I wanted to get a clean sound, it just required a lot more skill. And we're having this conversation and it's the mirror image. It's like, clean is what's baked in. And so then you're kind of working the opposite direction, going, okay, how do we make this dirty? How do we make this a little bit more gritty and a little bit more complex and vibey? And that would be kind of an interesting way for like new symbolsmiths to approach it. Like if you can get your hands on some Sabian blanks to work and have that be a practice way, and kind of know that in general, you're starting with, you know, you get all this stuff for free with the Turks, and you get, you know, you get nothing for free with the other. And so it could be kind of a way to kind of well-round, or like get a more well-rounded approach to, you know, making symbols. I wish I'd had a chance to work on some Sabians in my first year or two of making them. Yeah. That would have been awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to have the variety, which again is why I think, you know, what Matt is doing is so good, because he has such a variety of different things that he's doing and different alloys that he has access to, and it's good for you. But obviously everything has a, like, you know, when you're talking about sound and when you're talking about manufacturing techniques and the starting blank and the alloy compositions and et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, each different thing that you have has a kind of optimum direction that it seems to like to go in. Did you know what I mean? So, you know, obviously if you're going for that, okay, yep, very spicy, very complex kind of mid and top register thing, then the Turkish blanks are great. Whereas if you want something which maybe is working more in a rock context, as in it's still got a nice tonality, but it's maybe got a bit more volume and, you know, maybe the Sabians are better for that. But like, you know, every technique you use and every blank you use seems to have like an optimum window where, you know, if you push it in that direction, it resonates most with that thing, whatever that thing is. Yeah, I don't know if I made any sense then, because it's midnight here now.
Oh gosh. that made total sense. And it's like my weird brain goes, I always think about how can you do like the thing that doesn't make sense. So it's like, how could I
love that.
You know, it's like, can you make it's kind of the thing that we've all heard of. Can you make a heavy cymbal sound and feel like it's a lot thinner than it is? Or can you make a thin cymbal sound and feel like it's a lot heavier? It's like these juxtaposing paradoxical things. Can you kind of weld them into one piece? And how, because in the end that leads to more function. You know, if you maybe you're the kind of drummer that plays in cafes and there's brick everywhere, and so you don't want something heavy and pingy and bright. You want something thin, but you also don't, it can't wash out because there's all this reverberance. So you need a thin cymbal, but it needs to kind of respond and maybe feel like it's a little bit heavier and it needs to be a little bit drier. And so we run into instances all the time where we have to draw from kind of something that doesn't normally exist in, you know, this certain spec'd cymbal, but you want to be able to have the skill or the ear to be able to sort of at least aim in the direction of putting in something that doesn't typically exist and, you know, say something that's super thin or something that's heavy or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Like maybe that's like a way of just challenging yourself. Maybe that's, you know, like a part of the whole learning experience of it, you know, to challenge yourself in those different ways with different things.
Do you think there's like a utility in it though?
Probably. I have moments where I'm, you know, a total contrarian, and like I remember in the early days of Cymbalholic, Mike Skiba always used to talk about not overworking bridges and you've got to be really careful with that area. So because I'm a contrarian, the first thing I did was just hammered the crap out of bridges on a whole bunch of cymbals, more because I just wanted to learn about that kind of stuff. And again, partly because I am a contrarian, you know, people tell me to do something, it's like, maybe I could do something else. So, yeah. But I guess that's more for a learning experience, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's fun to do. And it's all about pushing boundaries, which is part of what we're trying to do. So,
yeah, you kind of have to, I said it in this to my friend the other day recently, and I kind of liked the image it brought to my mind, but it's like, you just kind of throw your tentacles as far out as you can get them. And then you're just kind of feeling around in the dark, trying to, you know, yeah, and then you end up kind of reeling things back in. You want to do the most extreme, you know, crazy complex sound so that you know what is too far. You've actually experienced, you know, too far, and you can kind of reel it back. And you know, I see it in the way like you're learning to see on a more micro scale, because in the beginning everything is just wide and big and you can't really tell the subtle differences between sounds. You know, you hit a cymbal and you go, oh my God, it's so complex. But when you get, I don't know, maybe as you get more experience, things kind of zone in and you're able to see like almost like you're seeing microscopic differences in the complexity of a cymbal. And so, you know, you don't want to, like Craig, you and I talked about like cooking and how that relates to cymbals and how you don't want to like over season your steak. You don't want to add way too much salt to the steak, because then you can't taste the steak and all you taste is salt. Or maybe it's like spice and all you taste is spice, and you're not tasting the actual thing itself. And so you do too much in order to kind of reel it back and find a more refined way of adding certain sonic characteristics to a symbol.
Yeah. But also too, I think I was thinking about this the other day, like it's also about just experiencing things. Like you want to have that width of experience, which is pushing boundaries. You know, like you don't want your experience to exist in this tiny narrow window. Like as a human, being able to be really smooth is good for a bit, but you also want to be outrageous and happy and do crazy stuff. And you also have to go through grief and despair and all, like you have that width of experience. But part of that width of experience is hopefully eventually so that you can then be more accurate about where you're experiencing things along that spectrum of that width.
Yeah.
That's really, I think what you're talking about, maybe again, it's pretty late and I'm really tired. But
we can wrap this up at any time, whatever.
It's cool. I'm loving it. But I had a tour on the weekend, and you know, I spent 20 hours in a car over 2 days and didn't sleep at night, and I'm still suffering from that. But hey, look, it's cool. I might say some really funny stuff that completely take out of context at a later date.
Perfect.
I have no idea what he's talking about. Listen to what he said there.
Oh man, you win the war for most dedicated in this podcast. Most dedicated.
As you know, it's impossible to find a sensible time between all of it.
Yeah, for those who don't know, we've got Australia, we've got the UK, and we've got North Carolina happening all at the same time. So we've kind of covered the entire 24-hour spectrum in different increments. We've kind of just mashed it together.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Man. I have it the easiest, but I think you're just following your paradigm, Craig, of exploring the limits and trying to find out where they are by being as tired as possible before a podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
I feel like this has been amazing, though, just being able to, I don't know, I feel like this is one of the more interesting, I didn't know how it was going to go with three people, and we were going to have Dave Collingwood join us as well, but he just came from the UK to the US, and he's been traveling, so he's probably trying to recover, but I didn't know how it was going to go with like a three-way podcast. I've never done anything like this, but it's been awesome. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is the stuff rolls around in my head, and I feel like just being able to come to two seasoned vets like yourselves and basically throw these weird ideas out and see if I'm full of crap on anything or if anything is resonates. And so, really I've enjoyed it.
No, likewise. Absolutely. You said something also about paradox before, and that's another thing, right? About life, about the universe, and about doing any art or craft, there's paradoxes everywhere, which are really interesting. Like everything is a gray area to me these days. You know, black and white is much, it doesn't seem to exist so much. You know, I see the paradoxes in all the things, which is...
Do you think that's a wisdom and maturity thing? Did you used to be a little bit more black and white before?
Well, when I was young, I used to be black and white, I think, a lot more so. And I think, as I've matured and had children and, you know, gone to hell and back. No, kids are fantastic. I love kids. But, I think as I've matured, everything, because so much is contextual as well. So I think I'm just learning to just chill about things and again, just accept that there are paradoxes everywhere. There's gray areas everywhere. You know, like I also think too that the more fixed you are in your own thought processes about the way you do anything, the less able you are to operate outside of those, because again, you're naturally going to a fixed way of thinking about stuff.
Yeah.
So I like the crazy paradoxes and the gray areas these days. I find I gravitate towards them in, you know, philosophy, in science, in art, in all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. It's a kind of a way of, I find a lot of symbolsmiths that I talk to are, I've heard it described as like circular thinkers. as opposed to like linear, you know, linear is kind of, you know, A, B, C, D, we land at Z at the end and we have this nice line, we can look back and everything is categorized nicely. And then there's like the circular way of thinking, which is things roll over on themselves and then we contradict ourselves talking. I contradict myself all the time. And I can legitimately say, yeah, I believe both of these things, even though they're in conflict with each other, if you like put them next to each other. But that's kind of the way of being a little bit more, open and versatile, maybe. I don't know the way to say it, but it's kind of a way to be a little bit more willing to accept new information, which you kind of have to be if you're, you know, sure, you can go the Sabian route and you can be like, or sorry, not the Sabian route, the Peisty route, and be like, we are going to figure out how to make 10,000 16-inch crashes that all sound exactly the same. And, you know, that has its own utility because, you know, there's definitely utility in that. It's just not the utility. It's not something that's for me. You know, I'm interested in just exploring the boundaries and seeing what's possible, you know, and I know you guys are as well. It's like, I fancied myself a professional drummer at one point. You know, I was like, I'm going to move to New York and I'm going to do the thing and be a jazz drummer. And, I didn't have what it took. Like, and I know that now, looking back, like I just did not have the thing. I didn't know what the thing was until I started making cymbals. And I realized the thing was curiosity, you know, it's just the curiosity to be like, you just can't not see what happens if you do X, you know, and with drumming, it was always like, I just was always a little bit shamed, like I should practice. Oh man, I haven't practiced today. And it was like I would put that on myself, like it was a shaming thing, and I would just feel bad about like, oh, I didn't practice like 4 hours. I used to practice 4 hours a day when I was in college, and now I can't practice for 5 minutes. But like, that's not even in a part of your lexicon when you have that element of curiosity about the thing that you love, you know, because it's like, it's not even a, you don't even really have that internal narrative with yourself about, oh, I should be doing this. You're just doing it because it's like a natural, it's like you can't not do it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's sure. I obviously everybody has different areas where that plays out for them, you know, but I know it's drumming and playing can be very competitive, and colleges can be very competitive, and they can put you in a really bad headspace, which I don't think is good for you, right? Like it makes you overly critical, and it makes you focus on the wrong things. Like you say, you know, you're not focusing on the curiosity, you're focusing more on, I've got to get this paradiddle up to 120 beats a minute, or, you know, whatever it is, that thing. And that's not really what art is about, you know, like that's a technical thing, but it's also, it can be limiting. You know, they did a study about, I think it was about exercise, and the way you felt about the exercise had a great influence on how much benefit you got from that exercise.
Wow.
So, you know, so if you're loving it and this is the best thing ever, you're going to get a really good benefit from it. Whereas if you're going, oh man, I've got to exercise. Well, oh geez, I've got to do my 2 hours. Not bicep curls again. God, I hate these. You're just not going to get the benefit because your brain knows, right? Your brain and your body knows that you're not digging that. And they kind of go, yeah, well, you're not going to get the same benefit as if you really love it, you know, as if it's a play thing and you know.
Is that what they mean when they say a body-mind connection? Because I've heard that term a lot, body-mind connection.
In terms of exercising, you mean?
Like your brain having an effect on, like how you think about things having an effect on the internal benefit of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely does.
Mm.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe a false dichotomy to separate the brain and the body, really.
Yeah.
You know, and even anatomically, we've got like a mini brain in your heart, and there's another one kind of in your gut.
Yeah, exactly.
And they influence each other back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah, big time.
Wow.
You know, and I don't know, some people are more aware of it than others. Other people maybe feel it but don't see it, make the connection that that's what's going on. Things like, the expression feel it in your gut, or getting butterflies in your stomach about something you're excited about or anticipating. Very clear and evidence that thing's going on.
Wow. Yeah, there is a lot of communication. As you say, I think everywhere, your body obviously has to constantly communicate with itself and get some kind of information to other parts of your body. So it is this, big holistic thing. But there are particular cells and nerves and all those things, like you say, around, it's a casing around your heart, isn't it? And in your stomach, and they have this particular way of communicating very quickly and deeply with each other as well. It's fascinating how that stuff works. And so, yeah, you're right. When we talk about from the heart, it's because we have that real connection, that real communication with it, or from the gut, we have that constant talk between the stomach and the mind, and it's all fascinating stuff. I love all that stuff.
Which kind of makes what you were saying about music school kind of, it's sort of like pushing you to think in a certain way and behave in a certain way. It's almost as if in that zone, because I was in that zone, I went to music school, and in that zone, you kind of are you're sort of pushed into just thinking with your head a little bit, and you kind of lose the sense of you lose the childlikeness, the joy, all that stuff tends to kind of get pushed to the side because everything needs to be very analytical. We need to think is your quarter note swinging, and you're focusing on quarter note swing, but so much of the greats, when they swung, it was a holistic, their entire body was involved in making that quarter note swing. And it was a lot about their own experience, life experiences, their own feelings, their own, all of that was going into how that quarter note swung. And so a lot of the people that I really look up to in the music space seem to have transcended this technical zone that you get in where you're really hyper anal about everything's got to be this. They seem to transcend that. They go through it. They have all the technique, they're tremendous players and performers, but they transcend it and kind of push back into a childlike space and a space that has so much more emotion involved in it, which is why we connect with it. Why the greats are the greats, because we're connecting with something beyond their technique, I would say,
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Technique's just a way of creating, an expression, creating a sound. So it's a means to an end, right? But it's not the end in itself. It's just a way of getting to that end.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever get there with my drumming, but you get the technique so down that you no longer have to think about it, and it just comes, and then you can put the emotion in and the feeling and the movement, because the technique is no longer a barrier. It's out of the way. It's unthought about. It's automatic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's not even in your mind's eye. It's like breathing. You don't even think about it. It's just there because you've done it so much. And all the greats have that, right? They just have that natural, beautiful, graceful fluidity, which only came because they've done that a million times. It's, and there's really no conscious thought anymore. It's just a natural thing that happens without any conscious, because as you know, right, the more conscious thought you put into things, usually the worse they go, because your brain gets in the way of itself, right? Particularly things like motion and art and, hammering cymbals and all that stuff. The more you think about it, it's the worse it gets.
Yeah.
Because your brain just gets in the way of itself.
That was always my problem as a drummer. And even to this day has been kind of an issue. It's just getting out of my own way to thinking too much. It's anytime I've gotten a drum lesson or had some of my buddies come to the shop and play, and I'll sit down and play and they listen. It's always they'll always just have a comment yeah, man, you got some stuff going on, but you just sound like you're thinking a lot. And I'm like, I am. I don't know how to not do that. It's like, I've trained myself, but I can go grab a piece of grab a blank out there and start swinging a hammer. And then I am slowly getting to that place of like less and less thought, just kind of getting there, getting in that like flow state or whatever. And so it's cool to be able to experience that in one area, you know, even if it's not the area I originally intended to experience it in. And I hope that that people get the chance to kind of experience that feeling at some point of being able to just get into a flow state of something where you get your mind out of the way and you're not judging yourself, you know?
Yeah, and that's a beautiful place. Yeah, yeah, whether you get there by meditating or doing a physical activity or an art thing or something, there's lots of ways you can get there, but it is great, right? Like, I don't know, probably you would have the same expression, being in the zone, it's that thing, which to me just means your conscious is completely out of the picture. I mean, well, it's not, but you're right. You're just in this beautiful flow state where you're not thinking too much about anything and everything seems to work and it's all easy and there's none of the self-talk and the babble and the stuff getting in the way, and that's in the zone. And that's lovely, right? Whether you're doing it meditating, lying in the bath, watching birds in your garden,
yeah,
you know, hanging out with people, whenever you're in that state, it's great.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of listening to this podcast with this, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's a psychologist that deals with, or he's a psychologist, but he calls himself a social media therapist is what he calls himself. So he basically helps people detox from like the online world and how addicted we all are to screens and all of that. And one of the things he was talking about is his practice. They would have people, they did a study where they had a bunch of people sit and their goal was, you're going to sit and you're going to stare at this wall for 1 hour. And that was, they were going to just, they did a study based on like the results that people, you know, reported after just staring at this wall for an entire hour. And, you know, they said that they reported people that had these amazing cathartic experiences, and they broke down in tears after 45 minutes, and they were having these, you know, crazy moments. There was a small portion that were just incredibly bored the whole time, and they were suffering through the entire thing. There were people that literally got so agitated that they couldn't do it, and they like got up, they couldn't even complete the thing. And he goes on to just speak about how our brains were our brains were evolved or designed to take in things at a much slower pace. Like we weren't meant for the high speed life that we live and the instant gratification that we have. We weren't built that way. We didn't evolve that way. And so his whole thing was about meditation practices to kind of bring you back to a place where you can actually be a little bit more in your body, as opposed to always outside of it, always taking in other people's experiences, which is, I mean, it's crazy to think that kids these days are like, their memories, I heard it said, like their memories are mostly other people's memories or other people's experiences.
Mm.
What makes up their own memories, because they're watching things happen on a screen, and that's becoming their memories. They're not having their real experiences of their own at the same level as people in previous generations have. And so I think that can be like a big barrier to all the stuff we're talking about, being able to kind of reach these spaces. And it's something I definitely struggle with, is just, and I think symbol smithing is really like the only thing I have in my life apart from family that I feel like has actually grounded me in something more real than just the online world and, you know, satiation of, you know, you got your Netflix, you got your junk food, you got your alcohol, you got your, you know, whatever it is, to just kind of take you out of your own body and just so that you can cope or whatever it is. So that's a little bit of a rant.
I wonder if the growth in people doing things like being a symbolsmith, I mean, in part it's because of the spread of information that the internet and social media has given us. But it may also be a symptom of people rebelling, you know, in their heads and wanting to be in the zone, in the flow state, away from all the distractions, finding something that they have the curiosity and the patience for to do, you know, long form.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Long form is important, right? Wow. In all things. Yeah, mm-hmm. I heard someone speaking the other day, and they were talking about how they always try and find things in the long form. So, you know, you watch a whole movie, you read a whole book, you like whatever it is, for that reason that you're talking about, Timothy, that so much of things are just short snippets that change all the time. It's also busy. It's also chaotic. And the long form is trying to get you more into that zone again so you can absorb things and just, you know, be in a different space, a more relaxed space when you're doing that. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's pretty meditative just doing that for 10,000 times a day.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Pretty painful too. I don't know how your guys' shoulders are going, but gee, yeah. Mine is getting a bit sore, but yeah, it is quite, I like that basic kind of, you know, physical, menial, meditative thing. I'm quite attracted to it.
It's kind of cool. That's my thing. I feel like I run to it. And it's like a sanctuary for me when the rest of my life or work day is emails and social media and posting on Instagram. All that is the rest of my day. It's like I run to the anvil as a sanctuary, as a peaceful place.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much like joy I find in that, because I'm able to just be like, okay, I'm not answering calls. I'm not answering texts. I'm not answering emails. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. So yeah, I agree with you, Matt. I definitely think that's part of the reason why it's becoming popular. It's not just that it's accessible, which it is, but even in general, just people that are, I've found this kind of like YouTube segment, like my YouTube algorithm is a lot of blacksmithing stuff and guys that make swords and all this kind of stuff like that. And there's a huge group of younger people that are really diving deep into that. And I do feel like it has to do with like a rebelling against this weird world that we're in, where everybody's just kind of like a zombie behind a screen, you know?
It's very busy. It's a very busy world. Mm. You know, we're constantly distracted by stuff. And I'm terrible too. I'll go, you know, I've got to do an invoice on my computer, and I get on my computer, half an hour's gone by. I haven't even started the invoice because I've got distracted with all the other things, right? Like it's, and I think I go, that's crazy, you know, like I literally want 1 minute on this computer to do this thing, but now I've just been completely distracted for half an hour, and it does that to you. It just draws you in there with the distractions, with the constant things that it's beaming at you. Terrible. And it's not good for you.
It's designed to do that, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They've got the executives of Facebook. There's this documentary I saw where they were interviewed talking about how they don't let their kids have social media at all. Like, because they know how they designed it. They know the ins and outs of it, and they wouldn't dare expose their own children to it, which says something. It's kind of like, feels blatantly unethical on one side, but it's also, yeah, it's telling as to what I should do. Like, these are the people that designed it, and they use a lot of tips and tricks from the gambling industry to kind of, you know, putting that in the technology, and they know all the studies about addiction, and they know how to wield addiction as a weapon to, you know, enslave people and just soak them dry for their information, their data or whatever, you know. It's pretty wild.
It is pretty well. I heard somewhere that there's more psychologists employed by corporations to do this exact thing than there are psychologists giving therapy to people, which is obviously what originally, you know, they're designed to do. So yeah, it's there's a lot working against the average person, right? In terms of dealing with all this stuff, it's. And, you know, Timothy, because you got kids, they get sucked into that stuff. You can see them getting drawn into that world, right? Like and it changes their brains and it does all that stuff. And it's a tough world for kids to navigate these days because of all of those.
I've learned the worst thing I've learned about that, or like the most disappointing thing I've learned in that area, is that it's not simply that I shouldn't give my little one-year-old my phone to look at when she's whiny. It's actually beyond that. It's that I have to be in control of my usage of this in order, because she's watching me. And so it always just comes, it's like a mirror. I'm looking at a mirror of myself going, okay, if I want to set my kid up for a balanced, healthy life, I have to live a balanced, healthy life. I can't just impose these rules and say, you're not going to do this, but daddy can do it, and sit down on the couch and drink a beer and watch a movie, but then like have my kid, you know, locked in their room with crayons or whatever. I can't do that, because that'll create an even more damaging thing in my child than if I were just to give her the screen and say, all right, you know, watch with daddy, you know?
They soak everything up, right? So it's they're observing everything you do, and it's not so much what you say, it's what you actually do, right? It's what your actions are that they're really soaking up more than anything else. And it's challenging.
Yeah, it's a good reminder to that all of this stuff, everything we're talking about, is, you know, I think it can be summarized by just we're talking about like being devoting ourselves to a thing that is more real and kind of connects us to our humanity than things that kind of pull us out of our humanity. And symbol smithing can be that, music can be that, any kind of art can be that. I mean, I even think business can be that. Depending on how you do it, depending on the how ethical you are with it, and you know your intent. All of these things can be avenues to sort of ground us in reality, in our own humanity, which connect us to the people around us. It connects us to beauty and truth and all of that. Or we can kind of go the alternate route and become more and more disconnected and just live kind of a sucky life. I mean, I feel like I've been, you know, for years of my life, I've kind of lived this like sucky existence. And I'm like, I don't want to live that anymore. Like I hate like ending the workday and going to spend time with my wife and kid and being addicted and being like pulling my phone out all the time and just looking at my phone. Like, why am I doing that? I'm next to this person I married and this child that we made. Like, aren't they like more interesting than this thing that's like, and it's the addiction. 'Cause it's like, they are more interesting. They are like a much more beautiful part of my life. And it's why like a lot of relationships can fail, is when you kind of lose sight of that. And maybe you just like give into your, I don't know, give in to the things that are pulling you, that are kind of taking you out of the, what is real and good. Totally separate topic, but I feel like it sort of maybe relates a little bit.
And it's the morning for you guys, and you've already gone there. That's impressive.
I'm ready to launch into the day. You're ready to, you know, launch into bed.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks for talking. This has been like an awesome conversation. I think people will really enjoy this. So I always do this at the end, you know, if you have something that's going on, or, you know, where people can reach out to you, Craig, where can people find your work?
On YouTube, obviously, my YouTube channel, and just look at my, you know, put my name in, it'll come up. And I still have a website, which is still called symbolutopia.com. There's a bunch of stuff there, and, you know, there's ways that you can reach me on that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and Matt?
Oh, pretty much the same. You know, my YouTube channel, Instagram as well, although that tends to be shorter form stuff or just photos. I have a website that is about 11 years old now. I've started to write the new one, but I haven't finished it. So apologies that the website is like so old and out of date and probably doesn't look in the fun very well. But it does have an email on it, and you know, I have a Facebook page and all those things.
All the fun stuff. And I'll finish by saying, if you guys don't know, if you're watching this and you don't know, Matt and Craig are literally, you guys, and I'm not just saying this to blow smoke up your butts, literally you two guys are like top of the mountain for me as far as the people that have inspired me. And I know you guys have obviously inspired, you know, a bunch of other guys in doing this, like, you know, in many ways, in many ways, it's like the standing on the shoulders of giants. In many ways, I would not be doing this if you guys hadn't have done it. And then, you know, Spiz before y'all and the old K factory and all that, all the Turks before them, you know, it's, we are blessed to be a part of this kind of lineage, I think. And you two guys are like major pillars, for me, at least personally. So it is an honor to talk to you guys. Seriously, not blowing smoke or anything, but
thank you. That's very, very lovely.
I look forward to one day being able to own some symbols from you guys, from both of you guys. It's my master plan is to have a collection. Like Craig and I talked about this, having a collection of pieces mm-hmm. that you can kind of draw, you pull out when you feel like you've lost your way and get re-centered, get, you know, inspired.
Your inspiration library.
Yes. So anyone out there, like, please check out Craig Lauritsen's work and Matt Nolan's work. They're doing amazing stuff, and they are some of the best to ever do it. I'll go ahead and say that. And they wouldn't say that because they're sitting here shifting uncomfortably in their chairs.
That's fit. Thank you. It's very sweet.
I know it's the worst when people do that to you. I know it's like
But I kind of like it as well, though. So you know.
Right. So there's conflicting emotions happening all at once.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you guys for listening, and we'll talk to you guys soon.